Excision number 11938, reel 7.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 7. We were talking about the retreat, the first day's retreat from the Dawnder, Mr. Iston. What conditions were the road, or what were the road conditions under which the men were marching?
In Belgium, there seemed to be quite a lot of asphalt or tarmac roads. France was very different. But Belgium, striking my memory, was pretty good on tarmac roads, and I think that we marched mainly on tarmac. Certainly we didn't do any fields. It was nearly all main road work that we did in Belgium, both going up and coming back. But France was entirely different. We'll probably come to that a bit later on. The roads, I would say, in Belgium were quite good.
Did you get any particular instructions from Major Jeffers at the head of the column during this long march?
No, I was told to follow along, and if he wanted me, he'd get a message to me. But he marched every step of the way, every step, all 35 miles of it. There was no stopping him. And I believe that he and the company commander, I think it was Cummings, can't remember, he and the company commander marched step for step at the head of the column. I did at one stage catch up with him. I think it was on a 10-minute break, and asked him if he wanted to change places with me, so him drive my vehicle and I would do the marching. But no, he was... And looking at him, he was that sort of a man. He would march... If he couldn't do it, the troops couldn't do it. And he marched every step of the way. So, no, we had very little contact during that stage.
What kind of equipment were the men carrying? Or was being carried for them? And was being carried for them?
They marched full pack. Having said full pack, I don't mean they had their valise on the back. They had the small pack on the back, a rifle. They were ready for action. I don't think we ever carried what we call the valise, which was the big, except when we were going abroad or something like that. There was a big, we call it a valise, that went on the back with some of our clothing in. And we had a kit bag as well, which was always carried on the platoon truck. They were nice and soft, so you could always pile a couple of bodies on the top of them and stretch them out on top if necessary. But also on the platoon truck, there was the Bren gun boxes. It is possible the Bren guns were in the box, or they could have been carried, depending on the urgency of the situation. In most cases, I think they were carried. Especially on this march, because they could have been used as anti-aircraft. So, yeah, on the platoon truck, there was a box for the Bren gun, three Bren guns, a two-inch mortar, the digging spades, picks, later on we started carrying the digging spades, but I think at this stage they would all be on the 50 on the weight trucks, plus a kit bag for each member of the platoon, 30 kit bags. Any writing, any materials for writing, which was very little as far as the platoon was concerned, that was nearly all done by company. And they had two 30 on weight trucks, a Cook's truck, the colour sergeant would have a truck for stores. The CSM had a truck for ammunition. So there'll be three platoon trucks, the Cook's truck, the QM's truck, and I think the CSM had one. I'm not too certain about whether the CSM had one for ammunition or it went on the Cook's, on the QM's, the colour sergeant's truck.
And these were grouped together in a certain position in the...
platoon truck followed the platoon. And then you would have the company headquarters behind, which would be the Cooks, the colour sergeants, and I think there was one for Or there'd be the OC company's vehicle. He had a vehicle. And they followed us as a company headquarters behind the platoon. So you've got the company commander with a sergeant major and a platoon commander. And then you've got a platoon of 30 men with a truck behind them. And then another platoon and another platoon with a truck behind each platoon. And then you've got the company headquarters, which is the colour sergeant, the coops and the ammunition truck. And that was one company. And there are four companies. You've got four companies. And then you've got the headquarter company, which was... the carriers were included in the headquarter company. I think there were 12 carriers. There was the mortar platoon, which had a vehicle for each 3-inch mortar, a 1500 weight vehicle for each 3-inch mortar. The ACAC platoon, where they were split up right down the column. The ACAC platoon, as I said before, they've got twin Brens on a stand on the back of a 1500 weight, and they were in various places all the way down the column. I can't remember whether there's four of those or six, but there's certainly four and possibly six. What I am puzzled around was where the band fitted in, because the band became stretcher bearers. And how they were dispersed through the column, I can't recall. It puzzled me a bit as to what happened to the band. The buglers became the ACAC gunners. We have them placed all right. They were on the ACAC guns. But I know the stretcher bearers, they were dispatched to companies when action was imminent. The band were stretcher bearers, as well as being band. They were distributed among the companies. The bulk of them were the headquarter companies with the MO, naturally. And he had his own, he had two vehicles, I believe, the MO. He had a 1500 weight, which we call the blood wagon, with the big red crosses on. And his own, I think he had a PU type of vehicle, or it could have been another 1500 weight. And I rather think he had a 1300 weight as well. So they were dispersed among those vehicles. And then there'd be another company at the rear. Battalion headquarters were part of headquarters company as well, but battalion, those used to generally have an advanced battalion headquarters and a rear battalion headquarters. Advanced battalion headquarters with the CO, second command, RSM, signals officer, the intelligence officer, and there's another one. And they became the battalion headquarters, advanced battalion headquarters. The RSM had two or three vehicles for carrying, the RSM responsible for ammunition. And through the QM, the QM used to do the indenting for the ammunition, but it was the RSM's responsibility once it arrived in the battalion area. And I think he had two or three vehicles, 1500 weight vehicles, to carry the ammunition. When we talk about a 1500 weight vehicle, that was its army carrying capacity. It was actually a 3-ton. In fact, it would carry 7 or 10 tons. But its official capacity was 1500 weight. why, I don't really know, but it could have been doubled up or trebled up or even quadrupled up. You know, it could have been a 6-ton quite easy. And I think in most cases, when the ammunition started to become scarce and the RSMs were getting hold of as much as ever they possibly could, they probably did carry 6 tons. But officially, there were 1500 weight Bedford trucks in most cases. Some were commercials, but mainly Bedfords.
Travelling at 4 miles an hour.
I must just point out where one particular truck, and why we got it, I don't know, was a guy. And it got drifted into the MT section. And this thing in bottom gear would travel exactly a mile an hour. We used it particularly for carrying, for pulling out the vehicles out of the ditches. And it would travel at 1 mile an hour. Terribly low gear thing. It was a terror to drive. It used to scream at you if you were doing 20 miles an hour. But, well, it was purchased for that particular reason or not, I don't know. But we had this one guy vehicle, and it would travel at 1 mile an hour. But it was a great thing for pulling anything out of a ditch or anything like that, because it was so great, steady, and take it away, it would just pull. No tearing the tarmac up or anything like that. It just gripped and pulled away. Sorry.
Did you have problems with overheating engines travelling at this very low speed for so many miles?
No, because most of the vehicles were built for India, or hot climates in any case, India in particular. So they were all fairly well equipped with big radiators and a big cooling capacity. So much so that they would freeze up if you weren't too careful with them. The only problem was the carriers. Might be a good stage to go into the carriers as well. They were a 4.5 ton vehicle. They weighed 4.5 tons. They had trucks. An awkward shaped vehicle. The front sloped slightly, and then it became straight perpendicular. So if a bullet should hit the front, it slid up the slope and hit the perpendicular, which wasn't a particularly good thing to happen. Because then you've got the full impact. It was open-topped. It carried our Marvis anti-tank rifle, 2 Bren guns, which again were a bit in a peculiar thing because they were fixed on the top. And the driver and the commander were below it. So if the driver or the commander should stand up very well and the gun's firing, they were in a desperate position. The front, as I said, carried the driver, and he had his a flat upright wheel, which turned the tracks to a certain extent, and if it didn't move far enough in that, it put a brake on that one side, just, and the other side track used to drive it around. On the commander's side, there was an opening, like an asp, an open space for him, where he could stand up if necessary, so that he can look around and get his goggles out and see what was happening around about him. And then there was his seat, and there was an aperture in the front for the anti-tank rifle to go through. Behind him was a bulkhead, and the radiator was in that bulkhead. On either side, there was a long seat for the one of the Bren gunners, or the 2 Bren gunners. So he carried 4 men, a driver, a commander, and 2 Bren gunners. And the engine was in the middle between the 2 Bren gunners. They were on the... It was armoured plating, 70mm armoured plating, all the way through, but open-topped. So if anything landed over the top, I mean, it was fatal. But they did suffer from overeating, especially when we got on the desert. And possibly later on I'll describe one or two things that happened in the... But I think it's a good place to describe the carry. It was tracked and it could travel across country quite well. Only problem was that on tarmac, with having steel tracks, it tended to skid on tarmac. If you're going fast and then decided you wanted to do an about turn, it would skid so far, and then eventually it would come round and catch up with itself. But it was a bit naughty on, and concrete was even worse still, but there wasn't much concrete in those days, it was nearly all tarmac. But yeah, it's a good place to describe the carrier. It was known as a Bren gun carrier. Why, I don't really know. Its correct title was the Universal Carrier Mark 1, 2, 3, or whatever one it was. But it was always known as a Bren gun carrier, and it carried 2 Bren guns. And as I said, our famous Riley 1.5 anti-tank rifle, which was the only anti-tank weapon we had.
So, your 35-mile march, do you recall coming to the end of it and the condition in which the column was in?
I don't recall it too well. But of one thing I am certain, there would be a foot inspection at the end of it. This was carried out by the platoon commander, all the officers, and in fact I have known where the company commander's gone round, inspected feet. And I would assume that after this 35 miles march that the company commander would be there. And any difficulties would be referred to the MO. The treatment would be to stick it with a needle and put some disinfectant on it, which is against all principles today. But that was the treatment in those days, was to stick it with a needle, let the fluid flow out, and put some powder to dry it up, and then to carry on marching the next day. But, I mean, that's not today's thing at all. They put a plaster over it today and let the fluid get away under its own steam.
So what time did you arrive at the end of the route?
Well, when we got to Broswit, the Cook's trucks came back and picked a lot of the men up. And then we went off as a motorised column until we got to Moyne. I can't just remember what the billets were at Moyne, but most of the battalion was in this little village. And we got there at 11 o'clock, leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning. We got there at 11. So in
11 o'clock at night.
So in 17 hours, they had marched 35 miles and we'd driven about 10. It wasn't bad going.
And, of course, arriving there quite tired, you had this foot inspection to face.
Well, the foot inspection and a meal, which was a great thing. That's where the cooks had gone on and prepared the meal, and then their trucks had been unloaded completely and sent back to pick up as many men as they possibly could. And they probably did two or three journeys, you know, to get them back. I don't know exactly what time the last ones got in, but it must have been midnight, I would think. Because they put them down and they let them get whatever sleep they could until quite late the next morning. I'm saying quite late next morning. How late, I can't just recall. But at 12:30 that day, they started another forced march.
This would be the 18th.
This was the 18th. Sorry, the 19th.
19th.
Yeah. They started another forced march. I'm not entirely clear why, because they did intend doing defence on the escort. But instead of that, the rules were changed. Rules were changed again, and we marched off to Lannoy, another forced march. I think I should explain that a forced march is not exactly running, but quite fast, and you only have 10 minutes break throughout the period. It's not a matter where you do an hour and then have 50 minutes and have 10 minutes break and then another hour and 50 minutes break and then possibly an hour's break. On a forced march, it continues 50 minutes, 10 minutes, 50 minutes, 10 minutes, all the way through.
And as you're marching, so, are you marching in single file or in some form of ranks?
Generally, if there is room on a forced march, you've got one section on the right-hand side of the road, one section on the left-hand side of the road, and another section on the right-hand side of the road, with just a nice gap. More or less the tail of one section and the head of one section, more or less parallel on the road. So they do get strafed. The enemy's got a job to strafe everybody. So, yes, and of course this again spreads the unit out, you take up more road actually than normally. And we did this forced march then to Lannoy, which is another 12 miles, just after we'd done the 35 miles the previous day. We do another 12 miles, and at in the middle of the night, The troop carriers came along and took us back through the places we'd been to, Sacklin, Arkenquan, where we'd been visited. And at half past three in the morning, we finished up at Le Bossy on the canal, where again we start to dig defences. And for all that were billeted in the hospital in Le Bossy, the CO and the senior officers and the company commanders, they went straight off on to do a recce for the defences on the canal.
Were you involved in this?
I took Major Jeffries along with this, with other people, because the troops were billeted down as far as they could.
Do you recall transporting Major Jeffries and others at this time? And obviously they'd be sitting in your vehicle. And do you recall any of the kind of conversation that maybe have revealed the situation to you, or did they know it?
There wasn't much conversation, because very often we took the intelligence officer with us. But in the PU there was only a driver's seat and a passenger seat. And it was a funny thing that the canopy came up and went over the driver, and then there was a glass window, a windscreen, with a canopy coming off the back of the driver's seat and over the top and down to enclose the driving compartment. And then there was a little canvas tube went out of that to the canopy that went over the back of the truck. So if anybody wanted to, there was a gap of about 8 inches. But if anybody wanted to talk, they could open the flap in the canvas and talk through the canvas tube and backwards and forwards. But to hear what was happening in the back was practically impossible. I suppose this was really because of, for the wireless operators, that they were as soundproof as possibly could be. And that was probably the reason for the gap between the two. Actually, the gap was used to carry the spare wheel. There was a metal box behind the driving compartment, and the spare wheel, and on top of that there was another box where I used to keep the rations and the toolbox and anything that went along with it. So there was a gap of a good 8, maybe 10 inches between the driving compartment and the back of the vehicle. So you couldn't hear anything really that was being said in the back unless they wanted to open it up and make it hear. Major Jeffries didn't talk a great deal. He passed his instructions, and generally he was reading the map in any case. So there was a, because France and Belgium, France in particular, their roads were very few. The tarmac roads were very few. They were quite good and straight, but there were a few of them. And very often, to get to a village or even a town, you would go onto what you would call a dirt road, similar to those they've got in the desert, where you had a compact road. The big difference was that the tarmac road would probably have a ditch on either side of it. And so that left the road, the tarmac road, high. The other roads seemed as though the carts or whatever had used them had taken the mud out, so they were lower than the fields. It was peculiar, really, that if you were on a tarmac road, you couldn't get off it, a ditch on either side. If you're on the mud road, you couldn't get off it because you got a hump on either side. So it was very difficult, and in fact, during the Battle of Arras, I had some difficulty, which we'll probably get to. But
you arrived at La Bassée.
That's right.
And were involved with this.
And then we went off for this recce, sorting out the where the various companies are going to dig their trenches and what type of weapon pits they would build and so forth. And we got back, and were preparing to send the companies out to this, to dig their defences, well, we got a report that the Germans had broken through and were attacking Arras. A D company, who seemed to have been the vanguard all the way through this, I don't know why, but they seemed to have been the vanguard need all the way through it, and the carriers went off under Major Jeffreys for Thales.
Was Colonel Miller back at this time?
Yes.
He'd returned,
and in fact, Colonel Miller finished the march, the 35-mile march. Whether he did it all or not, I can't recall, but he certainly finished the 35-mile march. So we went off to Thales, which is actually on the Vimy Ridge. On the way, Major Jeffreys and I went off ahead. D Company were in transport, the same transport which had brought us into Le Bassy. And Major Jeffreys and I went off on ahead on a semi-recce, and we stopped at a farm, and again it struck me how disastrous war was. The farm had been left, the fire was still on, the kitchen was in operation, the cows were in the byre, the hens were still floating around, so we decided we'd have a meal. And we had a good meal as well. Whether it was deliberate or not, I don't know, but as soon as we left there to carry on towards Vimy and Thales, we went through the anti-tank platoon. So whether Major Jeffreys realised this and he thought we'd have a meal before we got out into no man's land or not, I don't know. But because from there on, we're out in no man's land virtually. The Germans hadn't arrived, but we didn't know where they were. We knew that Arras, which wasn't very far away. So we had a good feed, and then we plunged on again into Vimy Ridge. Which I was quite taken with, because we were quite close to the Vimy Ridge Memorial. And also the trenches had been preserved from the First World War. In fact, Major Jeffreys used some of the wiring of the First World War to protect his weapon pits that he was digging on the ridge for our own protection. And later in the day, we were joined by parts of the RNF, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, who were our machine gun and recce. Battalion. The line there was that D Company El Thales, which was a village on the Vimy Ridge, to the main Lenzaris Road, and then the carriers did a little stretch across the road to the next village. And then the NFs came along, planted some machine guns in to strengthen us a bit, and two of their scout cars then patrolled the whole of the front, so that we were more or less a little bit relaxed by that time. A little bit, not too much. And
what date was this? Have you any recall?
This was on the 20th. This was the 20th.
You were ahead of the battalion.
Yes, we were away.
What was the job that you'd been given to do? Idea?
The idea was to defend Arras as far as possible from the northeast. But the German at that time was in the southeast, heading northeast and trying, I think, to skirt Arras. And we were there to try and put a stop to that.
Do you recall what you did that time that you, with D Company, were alone up on the ridge?
Well, I know that I had this little bit of spare time that I went to have a look at the memorial and to look at the old trenches which my father had probably been in, or he'd probably worked two of them. And I can't just recall anything that happened particularly. Obviously, I would be trying to get some food into Major Jeffries, which was something that he neglected. I had a problem getting him to eat, because he was a real old soldier where the men always fed first, and the officers later, the NCOs and officers later. He was a real old stickler for this, and with him being second in command, he was the last of the lot. So I had a major problem to get him to eat at any time, more or less. So obviously that was what would be my first request, first thing to do. And then to try and find him somewhere to get his head down for a little bit, which he never did. We were also waiting for the battalion to come through to join us, you see.